This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Coming off a news report that poor sex education in Malaysia is causing a rise in the number of abandoned babies, we have Lim Hui Mian from the Federation of Reproductive Health Associations Malaysia, or FREM, to talk about her organization's efforts in implementing an effective curriculum on sexuality education nationwide. Hui Mian, you said that sexuality education instead of sex education is the right term for what your organization is doing. What's the difference between those two phrases?
Okay, sexuality education, actually we normally call it comprehensive sexuality education, which is CSE. How is it different from sex education? Okay, sex education is just one component of sexuality education. Okay, and what is the purpose of comprehensive sexuality education? It's actually to equip young people knowledge, skills, attitudes and values they need to determine and enjoy their sexuality. What is important is they need to acquire accurate information on sexual and reproductive health and rights and services. They need to develop life skills, and they need to nurture, and we need to nurture positive attitudes and values for these young people. So there are actually 7 essential components on comprehensive sexuality or education. Okay, the first one is gender. Gender is where we actually teach on the difference between gender and sex. Okay, the second one is sexual and reproductive health and HIV. That is actually the sex education component. Okay, and the third one is sexual rights and sexual citizenship. That is actually in line with the UN, United Nations Universal Declaration on Human Rights. Okay, and fourth is pleasure, which means sex is something to be enjoyed, not to be forced upon. And fifth, violence. Okay, explore the type of violence towards men or women during a sexual relationship, gender-based violence, domestic violence. And sixth is diversity, recognizing and understanding the range of diversity in our lives, among, for example, our faith, our culture, ethnicity, how it actually affects our sexuality. And then relationships, you know, the different type of relationships we have in our life, family, friends, life partner, sexual relationship. So these are the 7 essential components which should be covered in comprehensive sexuality education.
And do you find that to be a harder sell than sex education? Because I think sex education, traditionally, most people consider it as mostly to do with health, you know, or with science, whereas what you are discussing today, it's much more holistic, and it's also much more it's much more emotional and much more social than sex education traditionally has been. And do you find that people are perhaps a bit more resistant to it on account of that?
Okay, like what you said, you know, sex education is more health related. Yes, I come from a public health area or field, but let me just remind everyone, all of us human beings are sexual beings, okay? We cannot compartmentalize. We have emotions, we have feelings, we have thoughts. And so everything has to be considered as a whole, yeah.
So having said that, what is the role of FREM? What are the types of programs that it organizes?
Okay, FREM is actually a secretariat. We actually provide technical assistance, and we provide linkages with our state member associations. In Malaysia, we actually have 13 states member associations, which means there's one state family planning association or state reproductive health associations throughout Malaysia. So we actually provide them assistance, and we link them with donors, we link them with organizations who are interested to implement projects or activities in respective states.
Your organization changed its name from Family Planning to Reproductive Health Association.
Yes.
Is this change in focus indicative of the needs that we face in our country?
Okay, I've done my homework, and actually we changed the name in 2009. Actually, it was quite late, because if you actually know about the national board, which is LPPKN. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with it. It is situated at Jalan Raja Laut. LPPKN actually stands for Lembaga Perancang Keluarga Negara. But in 1984, they changed their name to Lembaga Penduduk dan Pembangunan Keluarga Negara, which means the emphasis is no longer on family planning, but it's more holistic. And actually, this shift from family planning focus to sexual reproductive health and rights focus has been going on at the global or international arena since the ICPD in 1994. ICPD actually means International Conference on Population and Development. In 1994, it happens in Cairo, and it is a milestone or landmark conference where population and development actually takes into account the rights of human and women's empowerment. So this is actually implemented in Malaysia. ICPD is implemented in Malaysia, and Malaysia actually implements the program of action, we call it POA of ICPD, to deliver human rights based development. Okay, and Malaysia, being one of the country involved in this conference, has the rights to morally and ethically and legally bound to safeguard these rights among all the population in Malaysia. And apart from that, we have the Millennium Development Goals, which was established in year 2000 by UN. And in the Millennium Development Goal 5, which is to improve maternal health, 5A is actually to reduce by 3/4 between 1990 to 2015 the maternal mortality ratio, which means to reduce maternal death. And 5B is achieve universal access to reproductive health by 2015, which is next year. So in line with these two important ICPD and MDG, FREM decided that we need to change the name to reflect what is currently happening in the international arena and also in the national arena, as what LPPKN has actually implemented in 1984.
Of course, one of the reasons that we're discussing sexuality education today is the perceived rash, I suppose, of baby dumping and abortions that seem to happen in our country. And what's the correlation, in your opinion, between sexuality education and the incidences of teenage pregnancies, baby dumping, or other sexual crimes?
Okay. For a statistician, we will not say correlation, because correlation is directly, you know, if it does not has a direct link. What I would say is, from statistic point of view, there's association between sexuality education and incidence of teenage pregnancy, baby dumping, or even sexual crimes. Okay, and studies have actually shown that when comprehensive sexuality education is taught based on age appropriateness, there's actually a delay in initiation of sexual activity by young people, which means they actually delay having sex.
A module which FRAM helped to develop called Pekati took effect this month in 47 schools nationwide. How has it been received thus far while we're talking about young people?
Okay, Pekati is a long story. Let me just give a background. In 2012, Pekati was piloted in 33 schools where teachers were trained, and FRAM is involved in training the primary school teachers on the module developed based on what we had. And this year, it is implemented again. The reason why it wasn't implemented last year was because of lack of budget. So this year, they managed to get a budget, and it's implemented this month. 48 schools, in which 3 teachers from each school were trained. The total is about 144 teachers. So trainings were conducted in northern part, eastern part, central part, and in Sabah and Sarawak. So I was involved in the training in the central part. Okay, it was actually conducted last week. So me and 2 of my trainers actually trained about 45 primary school teachers. They comprised of counselors, special education teacher, which means they are actually teachers that teach in schools for students with disability, like blind, the deaf and mute, and also teachers who teaches pendidikan jasmani dan kesihatan. So we actually train this group of teachers on reproductive health system, the anatomy, menstruation, wet dreams, masturbation. We also brought up the issue on pornography when it comes to masturbation. Safe and not safe touch, which we label as pervert alert, body image, and fertilization. So our first impression, when it was a 3 days training, our first impression when it comes to trainers, our trainees were not keen.
Why were they not keen? Was it mostly because of, was it a cultural thing?
I guess because it's school holiday, and they say, oh, you have to come for this long training, and it's part of their work. And they thought, oh, this training will be very boring. But after the first day, we saw changes among the teachers, because what we actually did was we used the participatory approach, which means it's not lecture type. We actually engage them. They are supposed to draw, they're supposed to do role play, and we make learning fun. And of course, in the beginning, it was hard for them to actually talk about even the anatomy, to say the precise name, because I guess they are not comfortable with it. But after the first day, they began to be comfortable, because we have made it into a fun learning. So they begin to enjoy and see that, yes, it's something of knowledge. It's information impartation. And at the end of the training, we found out one of the teacher is actually an ustad. He was actually my volunteer when I actually did when she taught about fertilization. So he had to wear an apron which has a female organ. I didn't know he was an ustad, and I only knew later. And he took it as an opportunity to actually learn. And I don't see any of them actually commenting that it's not appropriate. And actually, I brought some feedback on what they wrote, if you want me to read them.
Yeah.
Okay. It actually surprises us, because we didn't expect that kind of feedback from the primary school teachers. Okay, so okay, one of them says, okay, many of teachers are not aware of many of the things discussed, for example, wet dreams. Therefore, this is a good way to educate them as well. Okay, a good course. Another one is kursus yang sangat memberi informasi yang bagus kepada guru. Facilitator banyak memberi tips-tips yang berguna. Dan kebaikan yang saya perolehi, saya lebih terbuka dalam hal-hal pendidikan seks. Okay. And bengkel ini merupakan memberi manfaat kepada saya. Sebagai guru, saya memperolehi banyak ilmu, dan sebagai emak kepada 3 anak, saya mendapat ilmu untuk menjaga kesihatan anak saya. So these are the overall feedback we have, you know. They actually lack information, even to actually teach or provide information to their own children.
I want to hear a bit about how that training was translated into practice by these teachers, which is what we'll get into after this. I'm speaking today to Lim Hui Mian, Head of Program Services at the Federation of Reproductive Health Associations Malaysia. We are discussing sexuality education in our country on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me today, Lim Hui Mian, Head of Program Services at the Federation of Reproductive Health Associations Malaysia. Hui Mian, you explained Pakati a little earlier, you know, that training module. Okay. So what I was curious about was, after this training, how are the teachers supposed to translate what they've learned when they go back to schools to teach?
Okay, each of the teacher actually has a module printed, and they're supposed to follow what has been given. It's more like a lesson plan, you know, telling the teachers what are the materials they need, what are the activities they could suggest. And we also had some practicals after we did our training. The teachers were supposed to present how they're going to actually teach this to their students. So some of their ideas we find very creative and interesting. And because they knew their students better than us, so we actually encourage them use any method, fun method, to actually deliver the information, correct information to the students. And according to LPPKN, which is the organizer of Pakati, they will do an impact assessment in 2016 and 2018, which means they will actually carry out study to find out if students in Standard 6 and Form 3 have benefited in the later age after attending this course by their teacher.
The previous experiment with a pilot sexuality education project was back in 2012, and it was seen as a success. How do you define success? You know, even with this impact study, what would be considered a successful module?
Well, one of the indicators for success will be increase in knowledge. But having said that, increase in knowledge does not necessarily translate to change in behavior, an increase in a less risky behavior. So that we will need time to really find out later on.
How is sexuality being taught in schools currently, aside from you know, initiatives like the Pakati module?
Okay. The Ministry of Education actually implements PEERS. PEERS is actually Pendidikan Jasmani and Kesihatan. They have a 30-minute class on that every week. So it's compulsory. However, having said that, again, it depends on how comfortable the teacher is on teaching this subject. And is the time allocated really used for teaching this subject, or is it used for teaching other subjects, which is exam-oriented ones?
What have been the main challenges that you've seen in terms of raising sexuality education awareness? Has it been that sort of reticence to talk about it? I think traditionally that's what we think, but is that something that you see in practice?
Overall, some of the teachers we talked to actually said, no, we don't have problem from the parents. The parents are all right with teachers teaching sexuality education. But some teachers did actually comment that some parents were against it. Normally, it is sort of believed that parents should do the teaching.
But are parents doing the teaching?
Yes, that's my question. If parents are not doing the teaching, then most of the parents would say the school should teach it. Then if the school or the teachers do not teach it, then who is going to teach it, right?
And parents are often advised to monitor their children's online activities, but how big of an impact does the internet or social media have on teenagers? Earlier you mentioned that one of the focus points for FRAM is partly pornography and masturbation. So how does the internet play into that?
Okay, I came upon this news just last week. Okay, in Singapore, they actually did a survey among school students. They did a survey among 836 students aged 13 to 15, and this survey actually asked the students, have you watched or read sexually explicit materials, which is pornography. Okay, the result shows that yes.
How many people said yes? And this was conducted in
Singapore. Just recently.
Right.
Yes. Okay. One in two teenagers here has watched or read sexually explicit materials. Okay. And they found out that some as young as 7 years old when they were first exposed.
And what role do parents play in monitoring that? I mean, when is it allowable? Or when should children, not children, but when should teenagers begin to be exposed to this, if at all?
Okay.
Because it's hard to prevent totally, I think.
Yes. Now with a smartphone, with iPad, it is easy for children to access it. Even if children don't access it, it will just pop up at times. So, again, how do we prevent children from viewing it? Probably we can't prevent it because it pops up. And what parents need to do is they need to actually teach or discuss with their children what is it. Not to brush it aside when the children ask, and to provide them correct information, because we found out that most young people or adolescents are actually curious. When they're curious, they would want information. And where do they get information? They will actually get it from their friends, or they get it from internet. Until and unless parents or teachers or their peers provide them the correct information, they will actually
be misinformed.
Be misinformed, and that is very scary, because like masturbation. Masturbation is part of growing up, part of puberty, but it always is linked to pornography nowadays, because they need something to fantasize about, and this is the danger, because you can be addicted to masturbation, addicted to pornography, and it will affect your relationship with your partner in real life.
So aside from time of exposure, what do you think is the right age as well to start educating children about sexuality?
Okay, I actually asked my colleague this question just now, and some of them say 6, some of them say 4. To me, I say 3 years old. Okay, why 3? I think parents or the public needs to understand that, you know, when we talk about teaching comprehensive sexuality education to 3-year-old or probably younger, it does not mean we are teaching them sexuality education. We are teaching them, okay, first of all, the important things is safe and not safe touch. Okay, that is to prevent pervert alert. And also we need to teach them about their anatomy, okay, to name their anatomy in the correct way, and not to use nicknames, because we find that there are a lot of cases of child molestation, child being raped, and just what recently, the case of a 5-year-old forced to perform oral sex on her dad. So that she's just 5 years old, and she didn't even know about it, and the mother didn't know about it until she brought the daughter to the hospital, and they found out later, probably with the help of a counselor. So to me, it's very important that a child is actually taught about safe and non-safe touch, not to be naked in public, to actually take care of herself, and to actually know nobody's supposed to touch your private areas. Yeah.
Which brings me also to the fact that abstinence traditionally has been the primary focus of sex education in Malaysia. And it was one of the things that struck me, you know, at the very start of our interview when you said that sexuality education is, you know, is so holistic, and it already assumes that sex is a natural part of life and that people will be having it, and therefore it's best to know about it, which is, you know, quite different from saying don't do it. You know, has abstinence proven to be an effective approach?
Okay, there are many types of sexuality education or sex education. One is abstinence focused, which means they only teach about abstinence and nothing else. Another one will be they will teach on abstinence. They will also teach on what are the contraceptive methods, how do you have safe sex, okay? Another one will be teaching on abstinence and very detailed information on safe sex and the risks involved. And the other one will be teaching just on safe sex and no emphasis on abstinence. From study, we found that the teaching, which includes abstinence and providing information on safe sex, is the best because it provides young people the information they need. What we actually advocate will be decision-making based on informed information obtained, which means informed choice decision-making. And it is very important because as much as we try to advocate abstinence among young people, but there are adolescents or young people outside there who has already been sexually active. From the institution, the national or government institution, when we surveyed last 2 years, a girl actually reported that she became sexually active at the age of 9 years old. So that is really scary. And we see 16-year-old, 17-year-old girls pregnant. What happened to them? What happened to their future? Will they go to school? Will they continue their studies? And there's another thing which a lot of people are not aware of. The Malaysian Child Act, year 2001, which actually states that anyone below 18 years old is a child. And a lot of people do not also know that sexual intercourse with a girl aged below 16 years old, whether with her consent or against her consent, is considered statutory rape. So a lot of young boys do not know that. And sometimes they are actually sent to gurney home because of statutory rape. And even men who have sexual intercourse with a girl below 16 years old, he could be actually convicted.
So then, how would you say, you know, we need to approach the topic of sex openly, especially in our classroom settings? You know, what would your message be in terms of that?
I guess what is important is we actually normally start with sensitization, which means we would actually tell our key stakeholders, for example, the headmaster, the teacher in charge, or when it comes to the institution for delinquent children, we will actually provide training or briefing to the warden or the counselor on what are the subjects we're going to teach and what are we focusing on. Once they have gone through the sensitization session, they would understand that we are actually teaching the young people to delay having sex. Because most of the time, when the young people do not think for themselves, then they will actually engage in risky behaviors. What our module actually taught is we actually assign them to group activities. One of the group activities would be, are you ready to have sex? If yes, why? So they have to brainstorm and think for themselves, are they ready? And if they are not ready, why? So when you actually put the responsibility on the young people to actually think for themselves, they will actually come up with answers, and it will cause them to think and reflect and see things from long term. They will actually think of the consequences.
Thank you very much, Hui Mian. I've been speaking to Lim Hui Mian, Head of Program Services at the Federation of Reproductive Health Associations Malaysia, about sexuality education in our country on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.